Log Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to Family Matters. We're so happy to have you all tuning in tonight. This show is going to be incredible, I think. And, of course, I'm here with my lovely co-host, Judge Michelle Lawrence. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, Jill. I'm excited about tonight as well. Because we're getting a whole new perspective on an ongoing, achy, nonstop, painful problem. So
ongoing,
I'm optimistic.
Pandemic happening to everybody all around the world. Of course, that's parental alienation, the words we utter all the time. And, you know, I am so excited that we are in the United States and all around the world on the fence with this thing called parental alienation. And I have seen it move. It started out in baby steps. It's now in giant steps, and we are getting awareness and education all around the world. And I think here in the United States, we just need a little push so that this word is a household name, and we will be changing divorce culture soon. I know it, Michelle.
Well, it's all about raising the consciousness. So, and really, what is it really about? Raising the consciousness early enough.
Yeah, you're
early
right.
enough, so you're not looking down the end of the train saying, how did my life end up like this?
That's right. When people are contemplating divorce, because we know divorce isn't going to go away. It's here. It's here to stay. And I think if we can get these people to understand that they can't use the hearts, minds, and souls of their children as weapons in divorces and try to enter into some kind of wonderful co-parenting agreement, I think it's gonna work, and we're gonna get there. It's gonna take us some time, but we're gonna get there. I want to say before we start the show that you had a birthday yesterday, and happy birthday to you.
Oh, thank you. It was great. My
it was
son
number
came
29
in.
Again. Your son Jonas was in town, and
he
that's
came
exciting.
In and, yeah. Well, you know, because I have this puppy, so he says I'm too. What is the word he uses? You know, too soft on the puppy.
Soft on the puppy. You don't practice tough love on the puppy. And I witnessed that myself. So
I'm working on it, though. I need a
I know,
show just for that.
But as we talk today, I think you need a show, and then you need a book about how to train Nietzsche, the miniature Pomeranian.
The good karma puppy training.
Good karma puppy training is excellent. Okay, enough silliness. We need to be serious now because this is a very serious subject. As an alienated mother, I sent an email to Dr. Craig Childress, who's on the line now. Hi, Craig.
Well, hi, Jill.
How are you?
I'm fine, thank you, and thank you for having me on.
Well,
I was very happy
here.
To have you on.
I sent an email to Craig today, I said, where have you been all of my alienated life?
Because I know
if I would have known Craig existed, I would have tried to get him here and help me, because I had ran into so many brick walls with psychiatrists and psychotherapists and everybody that was trying to help me and my children. It just didn't work out. But I want to tell you a little bit about Craig. He is a licensed clinical psychologist specializing in the treatment of ADHD, angry oppositional relationship disorders of childhood, and parental alienation processes. He has a secondary specialty background in early childhood mental health and the neurodevelopment of brain systems during childhood. Prior to entering private practice, Craig served as a clinical director for a children's assessment and treatment center, and he was the lead clinical psychologist on a university-based project for the identification of ADHD in preschool-age children. He has taught graduate-level courses in diagnosis and psychopathology and child and adolescent psychotherapy, and he is currently an expert consultant for eHow.com regarding ADHD and parenting issues. He maintains a private practice in Pasadena, California. What a lovely place.
It is. Yes.
Well,
and so you're
Craig, Craig, I have to say, you know, I hadn't heard your name until about 3 months ago. My chapter manager for Parental Alienation Awareness Organization in Pennsylvania, Cindy Corsi Smith, sent me some of your videos on YouTube, and you are amazing.
Well, thank you. Yeah, my background is actually in attention deficit hyperactivity disorder in early childhood. And so I'm actually coming at the issue of Grand Alienation from a whole different perspective that isn't my, hasn't been my field of specialized practice until relatively recently, until an example ran across it in private practice and said, oh my goodness, this has got to change.
Yeah.
And then I ran across it, the same frustrations that you face with the court system, with the mental health system, and so I'm doing what I can to do what I can to help change the situation.
Craig, when you started working with parents, target parents, and children of alienation, was there an epiphany, a case that came to your office that you said, I'm seeing too much of this, or how did you decide to concentrate in that area?
From my perspective as a clinical psychologist, I've worked with children and families throughout my career, and I work for my client who is the kid. And I want every kid that I treat to receive the same quality of care that I want for my son and my daughter if they were in the same situation. And when I've worked with ADHD, angry oppositional kids, I mean, that's just part and parcel of my work. But when I ran across the alienation dynamic, it is so destructive and so nasty that I absolutely had to do something about it. I can't leave the kid in that situation. And so that was the origins of my interest in working with kids with the alienation process, is that they just can't be left in that situation.
Absolutely not. And so I want to go back to what I said a minute ago. Where have you been? Why aren't – I mean, your videos are out there on YouTube. You're in California, and I'm assuming that you know our dear friend Jane Major who works in this arena as well. But have you been quiet about your practice? Because I thought I knew everybody in the parental alienation arena, but your name is just creeping up now. Why is that?
Well, because I haven't been working in parental alienation. I've been working with ADHD in essentially preschool age kids, but also older age kids, having to do with brain development and brain relationship systems. And that's one of the unique things that I bring to the field, is that I've been working in the neurodevelopment of the brain. And one of the initial things that I recognized when I entered private practice and ran across the kids with the alienation process is that the attachment system of these kids is simply inauthentic. It's not possible to present with this kind of attachment system. And so from my background, it's really easy to recognize. This is not my field. It's not parental alienation is what not what I have been focused on, or it's only emerged within the last couple of years as I've run across these cases and have been activated by the tragedy of the family circumstances.
Could you explain what that means to that the attachment couldn't present this way? Could you break that down into kind of layman, what that means?
The attachment system is one of two relationship systems in the brain. It was first identified back in the 60s by John Bowlby. And essentially what it is children's motivation to bond with their parents. And you can see it in its most basic and raw form when the baby zebra gets close to mommy zebra when the predator comes. It's a predator-driven system, and it's been developed over hundreds of thousands of years of selective predation on children, that predators are seeking the old, the weak, and the young. And so children are prey animals, and so they're strongly motivated to bond with the parent. And when now the attachment system can be disrupted, but when you do disrupt it, it gets dysfunctional in a particular way. It's not the type of system that you can turn on and off selectively. So if you pound it and disrupt the attachment system, it's going to show up as disrupted attachment bonds across relationships. You're going to see a number of different child behavior problems across all relationships and all settings. And what happens with the alienation process that becomes so apparent is that the child has a selectively disrupted attachment bond to the targeted parent, that the child's approach to the parent is not based on a desire to form a relationship, but it's actually a desire to leave the relationship, to detach from that parent. And that's just not the way the attachment system works. That even, let me just step back and talk about normal parent-child hostility, that angry, hostile parent-child relationships, the type I see all the time in ADHD and oppositional defiant disorder, there's three levels to angry. The first two levels are, you hurt me, so I hurt you. And the angry part is the I hurt you part. But underneath that, it's because the child is hurt. Something about the parent-child interaction hurts the child. The third level down is, the reason the child is hurt is because they want a relationship with the parent. They want to be loved by the parent. And there's something about that's not working for the child and the parent, and so that hurts the child, and then the child is expressing it as angry. That's a normal attachment system expression of hostility. But what you see in the parental alienation process is that the child is not hurt, and the child actually doesn't want a relationship with the parent. And so it's missing those two bottom levels. And so that's just not how the attachment system works. You know, that the children that rejected a parent would get eaten by predators. Those genes got pulled from the gene pool. So that's not how it works. You can get a disrupted attachment system, but if you look at the DSM diagnosis for that, it requires pathogenic care. That means the parent really has to pound it with abuse and neglect before you can disrupt the attachment system. It's not easily disrupted. I work with kids in the foster care system, and even kids who have been abused and neglected by their parents still want a relationship with their parents. And we have sometimes even had to convince them that wasn't a good idea to have a relationship with their parents. And so from my background in early childhood, this attachment system that's presented in the session with the alienation process is just not how the attachment system works. It's just that it doesn't work that way.
All of the children still want a relationship with the targeted parent on some organic level, on some brain level?
John Bowlby, who talked about attachment system, who first identified it, identified a set of behaviors that he called attachment behaviors, like following, eye gaze, cooing, smiling, and protest behavior. Protest behavior from children is an attachment behavior. It's designed to elicit the involvement of the parent because the child's having some sort of difficulty. Please, can you get involved with me to help me work this out? Okay, that's protest behavior. What we have with the attachment or with the alienation process is the child's emitting protest behavior. I don't want to be with you. This is different. But it's not designed to elicit the involvement of the parent. Instead, it's designed to detach from the parent, have nothing to do with the parent. And that's just not how that brain attachment system works. It just doesn't function that way.
So you have a skewed brain. You start having some pathology on the brain level.
It's not authentic, and that's where I begin to look at it and say, well, where's the child's attachment system? And the reason the reason it's inauthentic, it's neither functional nor dysfunctional, is because the child is actually being controlled by the alienating parent. The child is expressing the psychological structure of the alienating parent.
So
the child is not authentically there.
Let's talk about, in a perfect world, and many of the people listening today are alienated parents, obviously, as am I. Let's walk through. If I were coming to you and I would hope that I could get my child to come with me, how walk through the beginning of a case to the end, if you can give me some success story where you've turned it all around and made it the way it should be, where children should have both parents in their lives. Do you have a story like that?
Unfortunately, I don't. Mm. And the primary issue that's involved in this is that there exists a significant pathology in the alienating parent.
Mm-hmm.
that currently many mental health professionals are simply missing. They're not recognizing that pathology that's driving this whole process. And as long as the child stays in a relationship with the alienating parent, that pathology is going to be expressed through the child. The child cannot escape it. And
What is that pathology, and how do people recognize it? Although I'm pretty clear on what it is, there may be many that don't understand. Is it something that stems from something that happened in their childhood? How do you determine that your ex or soon to be ex has this particular characteristic pathology and is going to engage in parental alienation?
From my perspective, what it involves is something called the transgenerational transmission of trauma, that the alienating parent was themselves abused as a child and has a set of this traumatic relationship networks buried in their brain, kind of like a PTSD kind of thing,
mm-hmm.
to where there's trauma networks in their brain. But they've... flow under the radar for most of their relationships and most of their time, unless reactivated. And they are reactivated as part of the divorce process. Primary theme of the alienating parent is that psychological fusion, being one with the other person psychologically, represents safety. Psychological separateness represents danger, and that comes from early childhood experiences of abuse. And so as long as the marriage seems kind of okay and you're getting along and you can be that one person and meet their needs sort of, then that psychological separateness keeps the trauma networks quiet. But the moment there's that separation, psychological separation through the divorce process, that reactivates the trauma networks for the alienating parent. And so they feel this intense anxiety. They're out of early childhood, and this fear. But they don't know why they feel it. And essentially, it's coming out of trauma networks out of early childhood. And then they attribute meaning to, why am I so anxious around the targeted parent? Why is this targeted parent making me feel this tremendous feeling of anxiety? It must be because they are somehow dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
Anxiety signals danger. And so they then attribute this danger to the targeted parent. And why are they so dangerous? Well, they must be abusive somehow. And they're abusive to me, they're abusive to the child, they're abusive generally, and all of a sudden we get this reactivation of this early childhood relationship pattern. In terms of the pathology of the alienating parent, it's essentially has to do with significant features of personality disorder that are a consequence of that early childhood abuse. Now,
talking about the targeted parent now. You said alienated parent.
Alienating.
Parent has, oh, okay, sorry.
Yeah, has a personality disorder, or significant features of a personality disorder. And it doesn't organize into the nice neat categories of the DSM, but there's significant features. It's primarily narcissistically organized, but it has borderline personality disorder and paranoid personality disorder features to it. Occasionally I've run across one that had antisocial personality disorder processes and another one had histrionic. And so, but there's a generalized personality disorder there with the parent. And once all of this gets reactivated, this trauma network, the child begins to express the pathology of the alienating parent because they are in this fused psychological state. And so the child, for like the narcissism, the child begins to express this sense of entitlement and the loss of empathy and sort of the grandiose sitting in judgment of the other parent. And so you begin to see some of the pathology expressed symptomatically through the child. And because the child is expressing the pathology of the alienating parent, in order to treat the process, in order to rescue the child and restore the child to their own authenticity rather than just being an expression of the alienating parent's self-structure, we call it, it becomes necessary to separate the child from that parent, from the alienating parent. But when we do that, the child's going to activate into an extreme degree of protest, and the alienating parent's going to activate into an extreme degree of protest. And so things are going to get difficult and hostile and aggressive and nasty for a period of time in order to treat this. And in order to be able to treat that, we need the court's support, because it's only the court that will have the ability to break the control process that's involved in this. But in order for the court to act, we need clarity within mental health, that we need to provide the court with a clear indication of what needs to be done for the child's sake. Because if mental health isn't clear, then the courts can't act. And if the courts can't act, then we can't break this cycle.
So, Craig, do you think it's important for you know, there's a huge controversy right now about the DSM-5 and parental alienation syndrome being included in the DSM-5. What are your thoughts on that, and how do you think either it would help or hinder someone's case in court if it was admitted into the journal?
I would support the parental alienation syndrome being included in DSM-5. I think Gardner's conceptualization is accurate and good. From my perspective, I don't see it as necessary, because I think we can capture the whole process using the existing diagnoses within the DSM-4. The fundamental issue to me is simply that mental health recognize it in whatever form they want to do. And so from my perspective, as I began to address the issue, the whole parental alienation syndrome has been mired in such controversy, and it can't be admitted into court and so on. And I've got a kid in my office that's hurt, that is losing their life, their authentic childhood to this process. And it's not okay for me. And so that's where I just went back and said, well, let's just take a look at the DSM-4 and see what is the pathology and how I'd go about diagnosing it. And so that's where I came up with a set of existing DSM-4 diagnoses that will capture the alienation process, and that I would suggest that when you see this constellation of four DSM diagnoses together, that represents the parental alienation process, and that should trigger certain actions by the mental health field and by the legal system. And so, you know, I don't care how the mental health system recognizes it. It's, for me, it's just fundamentally important that we do recognize it.
I'd like to go back to what you said before when we were talking about narcissism. Because if the alienating parent has narcissistic disorder, borderline disorder, whatever, in the way that you presented it, I would almost say that these people can't help themselves. You know, kind of like the Twinkie defense. Now, it's not important to assign to them malevolent motive all the time, but to know that it's a disorder sort of mediates the fact that it's intentionally malevolent. Are you saying that?
I would absolutely agree with you. I would also, though, say that people have responsibility. And so it's to some degree, it's the reenactment of a trauma disorder, too. And so it's like a PTSD, a war veteran who comes back and is triggered on their PTSD. And it's really, you know, they are a victim, too. And so there's victims all over the place. And so from my perspective, in terms of treatment, I think it's important that we at least reach out to the alienating parent to see if we can include them in the therapy, individual therapy with them, to help them, because they were a victim of child abuse, and this is a transgenerational transmission of their own child abuse trauma. At the same time, what I see when I work for the child is that the child is being sacrificed on the altar of the parent's hatred. And to me, that's just the definition of evil, to sacrifice a child to hatred. And,
you know, Craig, I don't think I've ever heard it put that way. And I think when you say that, and if you sat two a divorcing couple down and looked at them, now maybe not somebody that has those selfish narcissistic tendencies, but maybe somebody who hadn't really considered using parental alienation as a tactic yet, to say you are sacrificing your child on the altar of divorce is an incredible statement.
Yeah.
And it really puts it right to the heart of the matter.
Right, and this is not an unusual process, the idea of an alliance between a parent and a child where the child is used as a weapon against. This is standard structural family systems kind of work. I do this work all the time. And so, yeah, and what we do is sit down with the parent and say, look what you're doing to the child. And because the parent doesn't have a psychopathology, they can recognize what they're doing, and they love their child, and they stop doing it. Okay, and that's called structural family system psychotherapy. What I run into when working with the alienation process, though, is when I sit down with that allied parent, they have this personality disorder and this trauma that creates this persecutory delusion, and it's impossible to get them to change. It's impossible because of the severity of their psychopathology. And at that point, that's when we need to take additional steps to rescue the child.
Well, you know what's interesting? Can you guys hear me okay?
Yeah, mm-hmm. You're okay. You're a little loud with that background noise there, Missy, but I'm okay. I'm muting you sometimes, so.
I guess I'll have to go into my fallout shelter
shelter, yes.
Anyway, when I have alienating parents come into my courtroom, they will look me in the eye and they will say, I never said a bad word about their mother or their father. And from your body of work that I've read with the idea of mirror neurons, children picking up without a word exactly how they're supposed to feel about the other parent. I'd like you to say something about how that works, because we have some judges and lawyers who listen also, and sometimes you can't get a quote from the alienating parent to show that they actually said something.
Right, and I wouldn't expect to be able to. That's another area that is an advantage of my coming out of early childhood, because there's two relationship networks that we've identified in early childhood. First is the attachment system, but beginning about 1980s and really since the 2000s, we've identified a second relationship system having to do with psychological connection that's called intersubjectivity. Essentially, it involves a shared subjective experience. Ed Tronick at Harvard calls it a dyadic state of consciousness, which I love that phrase, a dyadic state of consciousness. Mm-hmm. And it underlying this brain relationship system is a set of brain cells called mirror neurons. And what the mirror neurons do is they allow us to feel what other people feel as if we were having the experience ourselves. And where we see this most clearly is when we go into the movie theater. We go into the movie theater, we feel what the actors feel as if we were having that experience ourselves. And the actors never need to, you know, display the emotion like in melodrama. We just psychologically connect to them and resonate with what they're feeling. And because we've identified the brain cells involved, we've actually been able to put this system under brain scans and we put goggles on people and measure it in brain scans and see what it's designed to register. And it's designed to register the intention of other people. What's motivating their actions? And from my perspective, as I run into the child who is being captivated within the alienation process, is the psychological fusion between the child and the alienating parent represents a hyperactivation of this intersubjective system and the mirror neuron system, whereby the child has lost the ability to differentiate what is their own authentic experience from what is the imported experience that's coming through the mirror neuron network and the intersubjective system from the alienating parent. And so the child experiences the intentions and feeling state and psychological state of the alienating parent as if it was authentic to the child. So similar to if we went into the movie theater and actually believed that we were having the experience of the actors, that would be psychotic. Well, in a similar sort of way, the child is actually believing that the experience of the alienating parent is authentic to them. And so that's, you know, where one of the diagnoses of that shared delusion and shared psychotic disorder comes from. The child is no longer capable of differentiating their own authentic experience from that which is being imported through this mirror neuron network in the intersubjective system.
Well, I want you to know how important it is what you're saying. Because what you're saying is, when we do the child custody evaluations, and you have an evaluator who says, no, the child was very believable. I think that A, B, and C did happen. I did not read that the child was programmed or made it up. Therefore, it must be true. And what you're saying is that there is a transmission capability which reconfigures the child's reality so it does come out as truth, so that the evaluators have to look way beyond that and consider a whole other stratosphere.
Yes, that's absolutely right. That's absolutely right. That you cannot take the child's statements at face value, because the child has lost the capacity to differentiate their own experience from that of the alienating parent. It's a hyperactivation of this one relationship system. It's an inflamed relationship system. And so we need to begin to look at symptoms and symptom expression and the patterns of symptom expression to identify the alienation process, or to identify the psychopathology in the alienating parent, and then to recognize the child's expression of that psychopathology in the current relationship patterns, and then, okay, now we get all the set of diagnoses begin to fall into place, and that's how we go about identifying and making the diagnosis.
So what would you like to see the evaluators do differently? Because it's not just at face value, because trained psychologists, evaluators, are not going to take it exactly at face value. It's a whole other level way beyond not just face value. They're going to have to see, how can you test? How can you screen for a child picking up the mirror neuron? This is very obtuse.
That's true. What you would first, the first thing that should identify the presence of the alienation process is what's called a splitting dynamic. And the splitting dynamic is characteristic of a borderline personality disorder process. And the splitting dynamic is where the representational networks in the brain for relationships get split into the either all good or all bad. There's no gray area, either all good or all bad. And as expressed within the alienation process, this splitting occurs between two people, whereby the alienating parent becomes the all-good idealized parent, 100% wonderful, positive, and the targeted parent becomes the all-bad, evil parent. And so the first thing that should be recognized is this all-good, all-bad split instead of shades of gray. Once the splitting dynamic is recognized within the process, then the evaluator should look for other personality disorder features with the alienating parent. Okay, now, I've developed a nomenclature that takes the word alienating off of them because I think it's a little pejorative. But it's with the beta parent in this case. With the alienating parent, you want to look for narcissistic features having to do with sort of this grandiose, I'm the all-wonderful parent, and the idealization, hyper-idealization of the parent by the child, and then the absolute rejection of the targeted parent by the child. And in this respect, because there's the borderline personality disorder process there, at the core of borderline personality disorder is a fear of abandonment. And so I have an alienating parent who has borderline features, this fundamental core fear of abandonment that is being split and projected onto the participants, so that the alienating parent is the never-to-be-abandoned parent. The child will never abandon them. They are the idealized, wonderful parent. At the meantime, the targeted parent is the entirely abandoned parent. And so from my perspective, it's not so much that targeted parent is being rejected, they're being abandoned. And in that way, the alienating parent is able to project their fear of abandonment over to the targeted parent. You're the one that's being abandoned, not me. I'm the.
Wow.
And so what the the court evaluator needs to do is begin to identify the psychopathology of the alienating parent rather than looking at the child per se. And once the alienating parent's psychopathology, the other feature is that it emerges as delusional disorder that says the targeted parent is somehow abusive. And if you look at that, there is no evidence that the targeted parent is abusive, that their parenting is normal range. If anything, it's even a little superior. They're making extraordinary efforts to form a relationship with the child. And so that needs to be carefully evaluated. And so you look at that and say, is there anything in the parenting behavior of the targeted parent that could account for the child's hostility or rejection? And what you do is you look at specific behavioral sequences. What took place? What did the child do? What did you do in response? What did the child do? What did the parent do? And you look at these behavioral sequences. And what you will see when you analyze them is that the child is not the victim of abuse. The child is the perpetrator of abuse. And so when you recognize that, the child is the perpetrator of abuse, then the whole sort of narrative construction begins to fall apart.
Could you explain that further? The child is the perpetrator. I mean, because they're carrying it out for the parent.
Well, when I do my assessment, because from my perspective, I want to believe the child. You're telling me this is an awful parent. I want to believe you. Okay, and so let's look at what happened here. So what took place? Tell me a specific incident. Okay, so you were, in the kitchen, and your, mom told you to, empty the dishwasher. And so what did you do? How did your mom respond? And what did you do in response? And I will ask each of the participants about three or four of these individual incidents of what took place. And consistently what I will see is that the parent's behavior is entirely normal range. They're not doing anything problematic. Okay. But what I see from the child is they are excessively hostile. They're the ones that provoke the conflict, but then they will immediately turn and say, no, I'm the victim. No, so for example, they will provoke a conflict. They will say something really rude, mean, and nasty to the parent.
Okay.
The parent will then apply a punishment or a consequence and say, okay, if you're going to talk to me with that foul language, no TV for you tonight. And then when I ask the child, so why are you so angry with them? They will say, because they took my TV away.
Mm-hmm.
I say, well, they took your TV away because you were foul and nasty and angry with them. My question is, why were you so foul and nasty and angry? And they will say, because they took my TV away. They will use the punishment as justification for their own provocation.
And why do they have to provoke? Because they picked up, they're carrying it out?
They're
carrying out that sentiment for the parent.
Yes. They're reenacting early trauma networks from the parent that have as their theme abusive parent, victim child. And so it is important for this reenactment narrative that the child be a victim, because that's the whole early childhood relationship of the alienating parent with their own parent, and that's the one their trauma network is being in. So the child is the victim.
Are you saying this starts even before the marriage breaks up?
Oh, yeah. This is a reenactment of trauma networks from the alienating parent's own childhood that are being transferred into current relationships.
So Craig, I want to just give you a story, and mm-hmm. certainly I won't say it's my own personal story, but it's in a book so people can read it. If the person that is the alienator had a father who committed suicide when the alienator was 7 years old, and then lived with a mother and grandparents and was doted on and raised and got married and had a wife that died of cancer and then was remarried to this person who took care of his two children and then had two others, and now all of those children are alienated from him. Tell me what you think happened. I mean, obviously you've explained it all. I'm sitting here going, oh, my God. It's all related back to what happened when this boy was 7 years old.
Possibly. Possibly seven, possibly earlier. If you have a parent who suicides, there's likely to be earlier psychological issues in early childhood. okay? Mm-hmm. We can never go back and figure out what took place in terms of those relationships of early childhood, but we're kind of like geologists that are looking at the current landforms and being able to predict what they were like millions of years ago or what took place millions of years ago based upon the current pattern. And so based upon the current psychological relationship patterns, we're able to go back and say these type of things must have occurred somewhere. And the fundamental issues have to do with issues of psychological safety and psychological danger. And that being joined or psychologically fused with the other person, being in a resonant state with the other person, represents a state of safety. I know what you're feeling. I know what you're experiencing, and that's safe for me. If I'm separate from you, that's a dangerous thing. And so when, you know, years later, 20, 30 years later, there's a situation that provokes psychological separateness, the divorce or the separation, that reactivates those early childhood anxieties and fears. And so the alienating parent has a reactivated anxiety, and they don't know why. And so they attribute meaning to that inner experience, and that's where things start to go haywire.
Well, if you were to go on the limb and say, if you're a person who's in the middle of contemplating divorce, and you had to, and you wanted to be fully conscious and aware of the potential of the person that you're married to being an alienator, are there things that you should look for or red flags based, you know, obviously you're going to be looking and thinking about your spouse's childhood. What would you include in that red flag list?
If I was to look at childhood sorts of things, I think some of the concerns would be a history of child or family history of alcoholism, domestic violence, or sexual abuse in the family that's entered. So there's trauma in the family. If I'm looking at current situations, the narcissistic inflation, to what degree does a targeted parent role need to fulfill the narcissistic inflation of the alienating parent role? And because with that narcissism also comes a lack of empathy. And now, for most, again, you know, there's a family dynamic having to do with alliance and enmeshment and using the child as a weapon against, that's within the normal range of child and family psychotherapy. And the issue that makes it normal range is that the allied parent has empathy and a capability to care about the child. They don't do this because it hurts the child. Now, they may get caught up for a while in this process because of their own pains and hurts in the process, but when the therapeutic intervention begins to address it and begins to highlight for them that, you know what, see what's going on, and this child is getting caught up in this, they're getting triangulated, there's enough love and compassion and care and ability to empathize with the child that the parent stops doing it. And so that's one of the core features as this begins to emerge, is to get it into therapy and get the therapist to recognize it and begin to challenge it and say, you know what, stop doing this. This is hurting the kid. You need to de-triangulate the child from the marital conflict and let the kid be a kid, and it's the conflicts between the two of you.
I'd like you, Craig, to talk about triangulation, because there are some people listening who may not know that word. Can you just explain triangulation?
Triangulation is a concept first put forward by Salvador Minuchin within structural family systems therapy. And he's one of the brilliant men of the, you know, latter half of the 20th century in terms of understanding children and family processes. And what happens is conflict in the marriage should be a two-person event. It's between the husband and the wife. It's between the adults. Sometimes, oftentimes, many times, children become allied or brought into the conflict as an expression of the parental conflict. And so instead of becoming a two-person event, it becomes a three-person process, and that's the triangulation. The child is caught in the middle of the conflict. Now, for the child, what happens, if they try to maintain a positive relationship with both parents, they will be psychologically ripped apart. And so they become the battleground for the parents. And then you see the child's school problems begin to fall, and they become oppositional, they become angry. You see just a mess with the child. I see that all the time being brought into my office. And they say the child is a behavior problem, and then as I explore more, the child's actually being triangulated into the marital conflict, and they're just a mess because they're the battleground for the marriage.
Mm-hmm.
And then that standard family systems therapy, you begin to take the child out of the marriage and look at the marriage problems as a two-person event and resolve those to the extent that you can.
I'd like to go just quickly to the phones. We have a caller waiting, and I'm sure it's a call for you. Area code 484. Welcome.
Hi, Dr. Chick. Can you hear me?
Hi. Yes.
Hi. Thank you so much, and I'm just sitting here stunned. Grateful that you're a guest and talking about all the elements of alienation, and I'm trained as a structural family therapist, and I'm an alienated mother, and I was presenting these elements to our evaluator and the therapist, and no one would listen to me as I was going through this whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I come from in my work more from a recovery from addictions perspective where we often look at family of origin issues, and personally, my relationship with my ex-husband, you know, I literally saw him looking at me as if I were someone who hurt him when he was a kid. And it was the strangest experience, but I saw everything you're talking about. And I presented it. I wrote up a rescue, healing, and restoration plan. And in talking to so many professionals in this field, the only solution was, you know, you have to get the kids away from him for a while for treatment. And, you know, they wouldn't do it. The wounds were inside, and they didn't really understand. I mean, there were times that I did not respond the best to the, you know, cruelty of my oldest. And they were 12, 10, and 8 then. Now they're almost 20, 17, and 15, and there's no contact with me. And I've been wondering, you know, how should I go back and talk to this evaluator, you know, with what you're discussing coming to light. You know, the younger two are 15 and 17, and I'm speaking with another one, wonderful person in this field. You know, he did tell me initially that he has seen healing through a program, I think, in California with two teenagers and the targeted parent and the alienating parent. But it mm-hmm. seems to me it's the court system that really, you know, they really don't understand, and so many therapists don't understand because these wounds are internal, and as a narcissistic kind of personality, at least my experience in my own case and others as well, is they present very well on the outside.
Right.
They're very manipulative, very skilled.
Marty, I'm going to let you go, and we'll let Dr. Childress answer, okay?
Thank you. Thank you so much.
The narcissistic personality disorder does present very well. And that's one of the features of it. In terms of the court system, it's from my perspective, it's not up to the court system to understand. It's up to the mental health system to understand and get clarity. And if the mental health system can accurately diagnose and get clarity on the issue, then the court system can act. But as long as the mental health system doesn't offer the court clarity in what's going on, then the court needs to is in a difficult position as to what to do. And so fundamentally, I think what the caller was identifying was the problem in the mental health system with competent professional work, in my view, that to do child and family therapy, you should be familiar with family systems work. That would be my take on things. And you should be familiar with DSM diagnoses and the ability and to recognize these features. Now, within mental health, within child therapy, child therapists don't often run into personality disorders, and nor do child therapists run into these persecutory delusional disorders, which I would frame the idea that the targeted parent is somehow abusive is a delusion. It's a fixed false belief system that's non-responsive to contrary evidence. But child therapists don't really deal with these types of issues, and so they're not sensitive to picking them up. But from my perspective as a psychologist, child and family psychologist, and I think from the community of targeted parents and people who have undergone this alienation process, it is becoming increasingly important to hold the mental health field accountable for competent professional practice. And that goes back to the idea of, do we need a syndrome diagnosis? You know what? We don't necessarily need it. If you know the DSM-4, you should be able to recognize these dynamics that are involved in this process. And so I think there needs to be a much more significant challenge to professionals, mental health professionals, to begin to recognize the process going on. And I think we've gotten off track a little bit by the
Well, no, Craig, I think that's great because I just found it fascinating when I was watching one of your videos that you were talking about psychotherapists, psychotherapy, and training, and how the training doesn't go far enough. How when they're ready to leave school with their degree, they've been trained to treat adults, not children.
Right.
And I think that's so important for people to know when you're living in Sangamon County, Illinois, which is the Springfield is the capital, but there is nobody here, nobody who can treat a child who has been a victim of parental alienation.
And even when they do are trained, they're typically trained in this humanistic existential approach of play therapy, that you want to non-directive and you want to accept the child's, you know, and help them grow and self-actualize. Well, that's absolutely inappropriate use with this particular process. You know, the child is being controlled, and it's not an appropriate model. The appropriate model is structural family systems or even strategic family systems, although there's even less people that know that. But, you know, we need to expect that people who are treating our children are good at what they do.
You're right, but leaving aside for the moment getting people much more sophisticated about all the nuances and the methodologies, what can we tell people, what kind of advice can we give if you are in a red flag marriage that's breaking up and you do want to get some therapeutic oversight, if at all possible. But what if you can't? What do the people who are at risk from being targeted, what are some of the things they should do, A, and B, if we're talking about clearly narcissistic and borderline pathology, what kind of hope can people hope to get that the alienator will stop?
And I want to just add to that question, Craig, and say, to add to that very long question, and say that there is a question from the chat room, Mick, who wants to know, once the parent realizes that alienation is occurring, what should the parent do to minimize that alienation? So it kind of rolls in with Michelle's whole thing.
Responding first to the chat question, very little. Okay. That the alienation I have never run across a process that involves such intensive control. The control dynamic of the alienating parent is extreme. And so as to what the targeted parent can do, it's very little. Here's my suggestion. Don't retaliate. Be good. Be wonderful. Continue to be an exceptionally good, warm, loving parent to your child. Okay. That will put the mental health field in the best position to then step up and deal with the issue. But still, it goes to the mental health field to step up and deal with this issue in terms of its treatment, in terms of its recognition of the issue, because the pathology of the alienating parent is so excessive and so extreme that without the support of the mental health field, the targeted parent is extremely vulnerable to this process. And without the support of the mental health field, the legal system cannot act. And so that's, you know, first and foremost, is for the targeted parent to be a wonderful person. At the same time, that's, from my perspective, that's why I put the videos up, is so that targeted parents everywhere can begin to direct therapists to the videos. So they don't need to explain to the therapist what's going on. So I use a lot of technical jargon, and I explain it, and I explain it in fair degree detail to the therapists. And so we should be expecting that level of competence from the therapist. Look at these issues. Do you see an access to personality disorder process? Do you see a persecutory delusional disorder process? Do you see this family systems triangulation and alliance and enmeshment process? You know, so that we should begin to expect the therapist to identify and support us. One of the most tragic things about this process is that the targeted parent is a victim of something that they didn't create, and they're trying to stop, and it's extremely painful. And then they turn to the mental health system and the court system, hoping or expecting that as soon as it's recognized, then they will receive relief. And then we let them down. We don't identify it for them. We don't step up for them. And so we add to their trauma of the whole process. Sure. And so I think we need, within the field, the mental health field, we need to seriously look at what we're doing and step away from the whole, you know, chaos and controversy that's been generated around this.
So, Craig, what do you think the answer is then? Because I have a lot of, as president of Parental Alienation Awareness Organization, I have a lot of parent advocates or PAAO ambassadors, and they're out there and they're trying to make a difference in educating the public and professionals about the results, remedies, and everything to do with parental alienation. So what do you think is the answer for mental health professionals? I mean, just going to somebody's office, knocking on the door and saying, look at this. This is Craig Childress. You need to look at these videos. You need to pay attention because this is happening. It's pandemic across this nation and around the world, and you need to step up and take your place in line to get this fixed.
Partly. And for the people doing court evaluations, I think it's absolutely essential that they understand it. For child and family therapists, they need to understand it. Even if they don't treat it, they need to refer it to somebody who does understand it. The second thing, though, as a psychologist in California, I'm what's called a mandated reporter, that I am required by law to report child abuse. Okay, I personally consider this as a psychological form of child abuse.
Absolutely.
Am I required to report this by law? Now, as I've run into this, that's the question I faced. I said, you know, the Department of Children's Services, they're not going to know what to do with this. Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of pointless at this
Well,
at this
let
point.
Me ask you this. Are you required to report Munchausen by proxy?
I work in children's hospital settings, and absolutely. We would have worked actually on a couple of cases that involve Munchausen. And, yes, absolutely. That's
Well, there's an analogy in my book.
Yeah, absolutely. I absolutely agree. And the... What I would like from the community of alienating parents is to get into the legislative statutes that if I get this specific set of four diagnoses, I am required to report, and then I am also indemnified from retaliation from the
liability,
the alienating parent, because mm-hmm. they are very retaliatory. And if I come out and say something, they're going to go to my licensing board and say, oh, they
yeah.
didn't. They're okay, so if I am required, the moment I make this set of four diagnoses, I report to DCS, and we start to hold DCS and say, look at this process, and this is child abuse, and we need to treat this like any other form of child abuse. If a mental health professional makes a set of diagnoses, then we can begin to change this field, I think.
Well, I hope that you can come back so we can do another show on treatment and what happens once the children get into treatment. And there's everything is so unique that you're saying that we have a lot more to cover.
I would love for you, Craig, to come back 2 weeks from tonight if you can. And if you want to check your schedule and let me know, that would be absolutely terrific. Just to continue this dialogue, I think is amazing. And I know that there are people who I have chat room going crazy, and they're saying, thank you for the gift of your videos. They are a godsend.
People find them helpful. And yes, I'd love to come back.
Great.
Terrific.
Wonderful.
Terrific.
And so everybody write in your questions so that
yeah.
we
okay.
can make sure we cover everything next week.
Absolutely. So 2 weeks from tonight, we'll be with Craig again, Dr. Craig Childers here again on Family Matters. And I think this has been an amazing show. He has some amazing new refreshing insights into the parental alienation world, which we're all a part of, unfortunately. And Craig, I appreciate you taking your time. I appreciate what you're doing to try to fix this problem.
Well, I hope to be of help to this.
I know you're going to be a huge help to me. So, because I do some training for the evaluators. So,
okay,
to be continued.
To be continued. Dot dot dot.
Right.
So, Craig, have a lovely evening. Thank you so much. I know all of my listeners are so pleased that you were here. Michelle, you're wonderful. Thanks again for being
here. Thank you, Jill.
And everybody,
don't forget to read The Look of Love by Jill Ajizi.
And The Good Karma Divorce by Michelle. It's good that we're here to tout our accomplishments. Craig, we will talk to you 2 weeks from tonight, and I'll see you both soon. Thanks so much.
Thank
Have
you
a great
so much
night.
Again. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.